Hello and welcome to the Enneagram 2.0 podcast. I am Urânio Paes.
And I'm Beatrice Chestnut.
And today, what is our theme, B?
Today we're talking about the Enneagram's three centers of intelligence.
Yes, we are three-brained beings, right, B?
Right, yes. Most people, especially in the West, think of humans as having one center of intelligence in our brain or our heads. But actually, according to the Enneagram system, we have three centers of intelligence, three ways of processing information from the outside world. One brain in our head, one brain or center of intelligence in our heart, and one in our body or our belly.
Yes, and even if we think about the brain itself, it has three big parts to it. The reptilian brain, which is more connected to the instincts, the limbic system, which is more connected to emotions, and the neocortex, which is more connected to thoughts, right, Bea?
Exactly. So the three parts of the brain correlate to these three centers of intelligence in different parts of our body. In addition to this, research recently has found that we actually have neural cells in our guts and our hearts.
Yes, that's quite interesting. Yeah, and memory even is not only, you know, cognitive. You know, our body stores memory of all kinds, and our hearts. And we use it a lot to work with traumas and different things. Now, it's also curious, B, you sometimes talk about it, that everything on the Enneagram comes on in threes.
Right.
You know? Like, you know, we always need to think of three forces operating. So three centers of intelligence, and what else?
Three types within each center.
Yes.
And for each type, there are three subtypes. Mm-hmm. So there's actually 27 types. But I always like to start with three because three is a little bit easier to understand than 9 and 27. So even though we talked about the nine types in our last episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the three centers of intelligence today because sometimes I think they're not as fully understood as they might be. And when we work with the Enneagram, thinking about the centers of intelligence and these three different ways of interacting with the world can be really interesting in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, before we go on with this, I just want to mention that the Enneagram comes in threes, as we said, because we need to integrate all three forces that we are talking about. So the deeper meaning of the study of the centers of intelligence is to allow all of us to be able to operate with all three. So it's not only about defining what your dominant center of intelligence is, but also helping you open up access to the other two centers and finally become a three-centered person. So this means that if you are a mental type, you may also open up, you know, all your resources in your body being more instinctual, and also resources of the heart being more emotional, and in all other cases for body types, for heart types.
But I think we need to start a little bit more back at the beginning. I think people who are new to the Enneagram may not understand what these centers are and how the types are oriented.
And as you know, you need to know that in our dynamics here, B and I, B sometimes translates me in two ways, both in my funny English and also in things that I tend to go deeper.
Perhaps.
Yeah, and it's our type biases, and maybe you're seeing right now or listening to an example by me on how I might become overly mental.
Yes.
And how B can become very empathetic with you who's listening to us because of her heart center dominance.
There are the centers happening in action right now.
Right now, yes. We are always very good examples to show you actually not only good things, but our own biases.
Right. So to start off with, we all have all three of these centers functioning in us if we're alive. We all have a head center that we think with, we all have a heart center, and we all have a body center. However, when we come to identify with a personality early on, when we, you know, adopt a personality to survive in the world, we, by definition, get out of balance. And so we end up coming more from one center than the other two. So as we said, I'm a heart type, I'm a two, and so I live more from my heart center than I do the other two centers. And there's a lot about the Enneagram of personality that's about understanding how we're out of balance and not fully in touch with a whole or more higher complete self that we could be, which is, of course, the growth work associated with the Enneagram.
I like what you're saying, Bea, because, you know, it's archetypal that we all develop a dominant center and sort of disconnect from the other two. So there's no point in self-blaming, you know, and thinking that we are essentially wrong, you know, and actually blaming doesn't help at all in the development, right?
No.
Guilt and so on. So it's important to understand that all of us come to this state, and only when you come to this state of using only one of the three brains or three centers, we will be able to later open up the other two.
Right. The first step in the Enneagram work is always self-observation. So it's about understanding and observing how you operate in the world. Like, for instance, for me, at one point when I was younger, I asked a friend for some feedback. And one of the things he said to me was that sometimes he thought I could be a little too emotional. And I was really surprised by that because I've always been pretty mental. You know, I grew up in a context in which education was really valued. And so I think I developed my intellect quite a bit. However, when he pointed this out, I really realized that actually a lot of times I was overly emotional. And of course I was sensitive and emotional at hearing that, but it was helpful because I came to see in observing myself how sometimes when I thought I was thinking objectively or just analyzing a situation, what I was thinking about was actually really colored by my emotions in really big ways.
Yes, it makes sense for a heart type. And even the first reaction of feeling surprised with that may have been emotional.
Right, feeling surprised. And also maybe, if I'm honest, a little bit hurt and it, like, feeling criticized. And I think one of the aspects of being a heart type, and especially a two like I am, is that I can be easily hurt by things. And that's a kind of oversensitivity that can come along with being a heart type, being centered in my emotions.
Yeah, so I can also share one example of myself with you who's listening, just to see how different I may be from B as a mental type. So in my teenage years, I had that girlfriend, and I decided to break up with her. And I did what I consider to be the most brilliant thing ever, which was explaining her the multiple reasons that made sense for us to break up. And then after I made my very well-built speech, she said just this, you know, I'm feeling hurt by you right now because you're just trying to explain it all. And then I wouldn't say I was surprised because, you know, the way I function as a five is like I was shocked and I didn't really feel much at the time, but I was sort of paralyzed. But that made me think a lot and see how I was very mental. And when I was so, I was disconnecting from my emotions.
Yes. And I think another thing that happens with head types, and maybe you can tell us how this happens exactly, is they can think they're feeling an emotion, but they may really be just thinking about the emotion.
Yes, and also sensations the same way. It's like using the mind as an intermediate to all other things because, you know, deep inside we have fear.
Or an intermediary.
Intermediary. Thanks for correcting my English. And I love learning. As I know.
I hate to interrupt you.
No, don't. Hey, I love it. Yeah. And I won't be surprised or shocked or hurt. Right, Bea?
Oh, okay. Right. I need to remember that. Yes.
Okay. So, yes. So, Gurdjieff, Bea, used to say that
And remember, Gurdjieff was an Armenian mystic who lived in the first part of the 20th century, born I think around 1890, who was
before that, 1870s.
And he was a mystic and had traveled all over the world in search of truth and knew a lot about a lot of things, but he's really the expert source where we get a lot of our information about the deeper meaning of the Enneagram symbol, and also a path of self-work called the Fourth Way, which he taught a lot in his life about how we can transform ourselves into our high and achieve our higher capacities.
Yes, thanks for summarizing a bit of who he is. And actually, the Fourth Way means the work with all three ways and or three centers at the same time.
Right.
You know, he actually divided up all spiritual traditions and wisdom schools in terms of what center they focused on the most. And he said that he thought it was better to work with all three centers in all times, and even in a confusing way for the student, so that the person that wouldn't get too accustomed to that.
And so correct me if I'm wrong, because I think you know a little bit more about this than I do, but did he say that, say, for instance, Christianity was a heart-based path, say Buddhism would be a head or mental-based path, and Islam a body-based path?
No, actually, Islam is also a heart-based path, big time. It's all about devotion and the recitation of God. So the
Sufism is. I thought our Muslim friends have said that the Muslim religion is a little bit of a one-ish.
Well, yeah, but this doesn't mean that it is based in the body path.
Okay.
You know, a body path would be more the Hinduism and, like controlling the body. Actually, Gurdjieff said the first way is the way of the fakir.
Like some forms of yoga, perhaps?
Yes, yoga is pretty much
a body-based
path. Or even people that in modern times do self-development work through Pilates or through being an athlete, that is self-knowledge of the body and controlling the body. And it's one very valid way. The second way is using the heart, like in devotional states, like in prayer,
focusing on loving
exactly
a higher power, God.
Exactly. And most Western religions are second way. Now Buddhism, for instance, is third way, not the only one. Like Tao and other are also
Taoism.
And but anyway, it's interesting, this concept of using all three, but not only for spiritual traditions, but also for us. So what Gurdjieff said was, we are subhumans if we're not using all three. We are not yet humans.
Right.
So to be a human means to use all three. Now, this may seem a simple concept, but, let's think of it more, in a specific example. Like, imagine that we we are waking up, beginning of our day, and then we are using the three centers in the way we should, right? How would that be? When we wake up, we immediately empty out our headspace from any dream we are having. We don't feel anything, and we come to our bodies and stretch, feeling the body. Then we stand up without much delay, and because we are in touch with our bodies. Then we go to the bathroom and we mechanically do operations in the bathroom, the normal ones in the morning. Then we come back, and that without thinking anything. Then we come back and see someone who lives with us, and then we get out of our body and come to our heart. And then we see the person and we smile, or we communicate, or just externalize any emotions that come. And we see the person and we relate to the person. And then after a while, we go away and we get out of the heart, go to the body to walk, but then we need to think about the day. And then we come up to our heads and think about it. So this discernment of what center is the right one to be used at all times is what's needed. Gurdjieff was quite demanding. He would say that inner work started when we manage to balance back the three centers, not that it finished, right?
He also said that one of the first steps in inner work is observing the wrong work of the centers.
Because right? They steal energy one from another all the time.
Right. So we need to observe, are we doing certain tasks using the appropriate center, using the center that's most well suited to doing that particular task? Mm-hmm. Like you sometimes give the example of driving as being a task that's best done from the body center,
yes,
or the movement center.
Yes.
That if we drive using our emotions or our heart, for instance, that's not really the right way to do it, because as I've seen some people I know drive from their heart, it means stopping too fast when there's a feeling, or maybe driving angry, which can be dangerous.
Yes, I can drive at times with my head when I'm not really present. And that means that I, you know, lose my way, that I'm distracted and so on, because the head is much slower than the heart, and the heart is slower than the body. Actually, I heard once that a thought has the speed of X, an emotion has the speed of 10X, and a sensation in the body has has the speed of 100X.
Wow.
Yeah, so, but even people who are body types when driving may make mistakes because they are in one center only. Like nowadays, it's easier to drive because of GPS that
right.
we all have. But some body types just want to drive with their belly and smelling where they need to go next. And, you know, they lose the opportunity of being more effective in getting to where they need to get by just using a mental resource called GPS, you know?
Right. I've also noticed some nines who tend to be very easygoing and relaxed and friendly drive really fast for some reason. They get maybe it's a body thing, but they drive surprisingly fast. Like all of a sudden there's a kind of aliveness and a purpose that really makes them go just very rapidly in the car.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Now, maybe we could then talk a bit more about the three centers and what it really means to be someone whose dominant center is in one of these triads, because I think you and I have an impression that most people don't really know how it is to be a body type, a heart type, or a head type.
I agree. And especially since these three centers are very foundational, they're sort of a deeper level or a more fundamental level connected to the type-based behaviors and patterns. So I think it is really important to understand what it's like to be a heart type and how they operate versus a head type versus a body type. I know, for instance, when we teach our course training professionals like coaches, therapists, leaders, spiritual directors on how to use the Enneagram in the most effective ways, we spend some time talking about the differences when you're working
yeah.
with a head type, like even things about how you want to sit with a head type versus a heart type versus a body type, you know, how you want to match their energy so that you can really form a good rapport with the person you're working with. So,
and people are usually very surprised.
Yes.
With what they learn.
And it's funny because as we've been teaching this, I've even realized how in the past I made some mistakes.
Oh, I made many mistakes
and
with you.
I think, and I think to myself, no wonder that 5 client never came back, or no wonder that 8 never came back after that first session when I didn't realize what it meant to be dealing with an 8 in terms of the fact that they were coming from their body center and not the heart center, like is my bias.
Yeah, so one of the benefits of learning about this is relating better with people of different centers. And if you're working with people of different centers, you may get across to people more easily, you know, and you know, communicate really.
And I know sometimes you're still mystified by me as a heart center, right?
What do you mean?
I know sometimes it's still hard for you to deal with me coming from the heart center.
Yeah, and the
since
same
you're
way
a head
with
type.
Me, isn't it?
Yes. Okay. It can be so surprising.
Yeah. Even when we know all this, it's still hard if we don't do our work.
We have to stay present.
We are doing our work.
We're doing our best.
Yeah. Sometimes we have hard times, but usually you go through them and everything gets better. It's important to have humor as we do.
Yes.
But anyway, let's talk about the body types. So what do you think, B? What does it really mean to be a body type, having the instinctual center as the dominant one?
Well, I think there's a kind of groundedness and presence in the physical body that is really primary. Now, of course, not all body types are always grounded in the body and in a good way all the time. But when they can really feel their bodies and be grounded, there's a kind of naturalness to that, I think, for body types that the other two types don't necessarily feel as easily or as readily.
Right, yes, I fully agree with you. I just want to make a discernment between what you called a grounding and what sometimes spiritual traditions and some good psychological lines call presence. So presence is being in the three centers, being full in the body. So it's not necessarily that the body types are present in that sense, but they are actually present in the body and being more energized in the body, more aware of the body, as you said, right? And what else? What else is important? I think we could mention maybe that body types are more based in sensations. Sensations become the primary way they perceive reality, right? It's like through the five senses.
Yes.
What are the five senses? It's tasting. Help me with the right English words, how you use it. Tasting.
Touch.
Smelling.
Hearing.
Hearing and seeing.
Yeah.
Right? So these five senses integrate what we call sensations. And some people mistake instincts for intuition. It's not the same thing. We are not saying that the body types, 8s, 9s, and 1s, are intuitive. The difference is that instinct is more a spontaneity of the body, while intuition is a spontaneity of the soul. It's the sixth sense,
right?
So it's not the sixth sense here. It's the five senses. Now, the body types, they feel those sensations first, and then they get access to emotions and to thoughts next. So it's actually about the order of the factors here, what we use first, how information is coming into us, what is the gateway.
Right.
I
think for body types, it's also about experience, as opposed to, say, emotion or thought. A friend of mine who is a 9, which is a body type, says when he's trying to make a decision, it can be very hard for him. You know, making decisions can be challenging for 9s, and he'll go back and forth in his head. But if he said if he can experience one option or the other, then he can know very quickly.
Yes.
So he might give it a try. You know, what would it be like to actually have the experience of making one choice versus the other? And once he allows himself to have that almost sensorial experience, then it becomes very clear to him very quickly.
That's a very good point. Yeah, so body types can't just understand something from a head perspective or feel like they want to do something, which would be the heart space. They need to go do and try to see what's happening. It's like, you know, touching with their hands, you know. So this is quite important. It's, I think, what you're calling experiencing, right? Yeah, so I think, B, that the most brilliant definition of instinct that I've ever seen was by my daughter when she was extremely young. Like, I think she was 4, 5, or 6 years old.
Mm.
And she said to me one day, Dad, you know, I have this experience. I think it's a little weird. You promise not to judge me. And I said, of course, my darling. I won't judge you.
And your sister and your daughter's a body type, right?
Yeah, I think she's a body type. Do you agree?
Yes.
Yes. So she's most probably an 8, but she doesn't know yet. Then she said that the experience was that inside her belly, she felt like there was a tube, like a test tube. Is it the name?
Yes.
Yeah, test tube. And that when something right was happening, that tube would fill in with green light.
Green color?
Green color. And when something was wrong, it would fill in with red color.
Interesting.
Like a traffic light. And she gave me an example of when she was doing a test at school. And that she would, if she was answering the question in a wrong way, the tube will fill in with red ink. Mm. But what she told me then that shocked me was, and I think this is crazy, Dad. I can't talk to the teachers about it. And I'm afraid even to talk to you about that. And my reaction was, can you teach me how to do that? That's the most brilliant thing I've ever heard.
It is brilliant.
Because actually, you know, we don't really value and we don't understand. And as a society, we, you know, we undervalue quite a bit the instinctual intelligence, which is exactly what she said. It's a knowing through the sensations. And she was talking about something she senses inside her body, mm-hmm. and she visualizes, she even smells it, you know. So it's a way of knowing that's very direct and at least as important of the head knowing and the heart knowing.
Yes.
But we don't talk much about it. You know, in science, for instance, we've been talking forever about the mental space, you know, the cognitive intelligence. Then we started talking with Daniel Goleman decades ago about, you know, the emotional intelligence. But, you know, not many people talk about the body intelligence.
It's true. Instinctual intelligence is very little understood and certainly not talked about. And I saw some people talking about this at an Enneagram conference once, and they actually talked about how they believed a lot of kids have problems in school because they're body types. They're, you know, they have instinctive intelligence, and it's so not understood. And our schools are oriented toward the head types. Yeah. And so
maybe teachers are selected only if they are not body types.
And also the things people do in school, like they talked about how marching in formation and doing things physically were really important for body type kids. And that wasn't even a part of the curriculum. And then when some of these kids act out or get restless, then they get medicated or something. They get turned into a problem. Mm-hmm. And it's all stems from the fact that we really don't understand instinctive intelligence as we should.
Wow, that's too bad. And, you know, when we are not really open to learning from differences, we think that the problem is whoever is different from us.
Right.
You know, there is a poet in Brazil who used to say that hell is the other, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, it was not only him who said that. But, yeah, so I'm very interested in what you've just said. What else do you think could help us all value the body intelligence, or whoever is not a body type, how could they develop that? Like you said, walking formation. What else? I've seen you talking about routine as something important for that, it seems.
Yes, I think anything that is happening in the here and now, the body is by definition the only of these three centers that is rooted in the present moment. Mm-hmm. And so I almost think we need a revolution in our culture that recognizes instinctual intelligence as equal, a co-equal center of intelligence to the head and the heart. I think even now we still privilege the head over the heart, even though we understand what emotional intelligence is much more than we used to. There is still a way that sometimes, I know in certain cultures, there's a stigma against being too emotional. So I think we have a long way to go in seeing these three functions or these three centers as equally important and needing to be balanced, ideally.
Yeah, great. And basically developing the five senses and our capacity to be in touch with them and to absorb information from them is a brilliant thing to do, to develop in the body center.
And I know that some of us, many of us, are often out of touch with our bodies. Even body types can be out of touch with their bodies. But I remember when I was going through my psychotherapeutic training and I took a Gestalt course. And Gestalt is a form of therapy that's very body-based and very based in the here and now experience. They used to always ask us, what are you feeling in your body now? What are you feeling in your body now? What are you feeling in your body now? Of course, this was 20 years ago. And I was always very frustrated because the answer was always nothing. I'm not feeling anything, or I'm feeling fine. And what I think was happening is I was kind of cut off from my body. And it was hard to see that and realize that and know with confidence that I could develop a stronger connection.
And how important was it for you, B, to develop this body awareness and, you know, get more, you know, conscious in the body center?
Very important. I think one thing that helped me is I was an athlete from early on. I played sports from when I was a kid. So that certainly helped. I was always very grateful to my father, who first got me to play softball and then soccer. But another part of it, I think, is continuing to exercise and do things that put you in touch with the body every day. Certainly yoga is a fantastic way to get in touch with the body. I think there are different forms of meditative practices that are body-based. And I think all of these things can be really key to developing an ongoing connection with your body, or even being able to see when you're not connected to your body and to you know, take action to become more connected.
I need to get more inspired by you and exercise more, especially walk more in the mornings before we are teaching a workshop like you do. You walk a lot.
Yes.
Actually, you get a little embarrassed to see you. You know, you're a good example for me and I need to follow it.
Yes. And whenever I say, don't you like to walk? You say, I like having walked. But I don't really like walking.
Yeah.
But I think maybe I can continue to pressure you into developing a liking for being in the body outside in the morning.
I'll try to open up myself more to your suggestions. But I also had an explosion of sensations during the meditation many, many years ago. I mean, 15, 20 years ago. And that made a huge difference in my life.
Yes.
Now, in my case, for instance, I am a five and therefore a head type, and I develop the sensations next. Mm-hmm. But the emotions are something that I've been opening up more and more in more recent years. So it's like this is the third center that I am integrating. But my point is, I know many other fives who opened up the emotional center before the body center. As a second center.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to point out that at least I don't agree, I want to see your opinion, with approaches that say that each of the nine types develop always one particular second center after the dominant one. I think there is no rule for that. I think that it depends highly on who the person is and the life experiences. But what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think it depends on the person. But I hope that you hurry up and develop your connection with your heart center so you can understand me better.
You need to lend me a good part of your tears.
I'll try.
Yeah,
we'll have to work on that.
It's so easy for you to cry and so hard for me to cry.
It's hard for me not to cry, actually.
It's very hard for me to cry.
Yes.
So, yeah, and it's not exactly about being a woman or a man. It has to do with the triads, I think.
Yes, it has to do with being in these centers or not.
Well, I admire you for your heart openness. And so I'll try to do more of that.
So, now, I think we need to maybe move on to the heart center, talking
exactly
about that. But before we do, I want to say one more thing about the body center. Lately, I've been really working on getting in touch with my intuition,
mm-hmm.
which, as you said, is something more about the soul than the body. But I think different people experience their intuition differently.
And sometimes through one of these three centers.
Exactly. And what I've been learning about myself is that when it comes to intuition, I get a lot of my information through my body, mm-hmm. which is very interesting. Sometimes through my heart as well. Like sometimes when I'm tuning into something, I'll get a big emotion. But a lot of times I get a sensation in one part of my body or another that gives me information. So that's been very interesting. And so we don't always develop, you know, our ability to access intuition in the exact same center that yes. we're based in.
Yeah, good point. Maybe we could talk about this in a future podcast.
Good idea. Let's do a short break.
The Enneagram 2.0 podcast goes live every other Thursday on all main platforms.
Become a member now at Chestnut Paez Online for a lot more Enneagram content from B and Udanio. Sign up for the annual plan and get access to hundreds of audio files, videos, monthly online classes, articles, and even full online Enneagram workshops. It's a great value. Visit www.cpenneagram.com.
Let's move on then to the heart triad.
Yes.
So you are a heart type.
Yes.
How is it really to be a heart type?
It's very hard.
You're already feeling.
We're often misunderstood, which is not easy. I think it's just, I mean, I wasn't always connected to my heart in the way I am now. So we need to say that. I think part of developing generally for all of us mm-hmm. is even getting more access to the center that we're already based in.
Yeah.
So when I was younger, and I think this is part of being a type two, I wasn't that connected to my emotions. It was when, I mean, I would get emotional, but I wouldn't always know exactly what I was feeling. It would be more of an automatic response that I wasn't always very good at managing or even understanding. When I first got into therapy, when I was, you know, late 20s, early 30s, my therapist would say to me, like therapists do, "What are you feeling now? What are you feeling now?" And often my answer was, I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And so the early years of my therapy, I think, were all about me getting more connected to my emotions. Now, again, it doesn't mean I wasn't coming from my emotions. It just was I wasn't always accessing my emotions in a clear or coherent way. But over time, as I worked on this, I became more able to label my emotions and understand what I was feeling in the moment. And now I would say many years later, I'm very emotional. I usually understand what I'm feeling pretty well when it happens. And now it's really about managing my emotions. You know, I'll know when I'm angry. I'll know when I'm sad. Sometimes I'll be having a lot of a big emotional reaction and I have to sort out if there's a combination of feelings in there. But I would say I'm generally very emotional and I experience a lot of life through either my emotional reactions to things or my avoidance of things based on wanting to avoid, say, feeling bad.
Right, yeah. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that you're referring to some specific things for type 2 within the heart triad. Because it's easier for them to be in touch with other people's emotions than with their own.
Yes.
Right? And another thing is, although you are not much in touch with your own emotions in the beginning, I know you're very much so right now, you were already emotional in general, right? You've always been emotional,
yes.
But not necessarily in touch with your own emotions. Is this correct? Is this a good description or not?
Well, I would say not always having a clear and coherent connection to being able to say what I was feeling in the moment and describe it accurately.
But were you emotional in the inside, at least?
I would say, yeah, I would have a big emotional reaction, but sometimes it would take me by surprise. Or sometimes if you asked me what I was feeling and why, I wouldn't know. So I had to work to almost develop a stronger connection between my consciousness and my emotional responses, let's say.
Makes sense. Now, I get really surprised at times about some capacities that heart types like you have. And I want to start talking about them. It's hard to describe them, but then maybe you can explain this more. It's like, it's not cognitive at all. And you hard types have this capacity of feeling whatever anyone else in the room is feeling. And only by the person getting into the room, it's like there is an antenna in the heart that goes inside the other person's heart and just feels what the other one is feeling. It's obviously a very differentiated capacity for empathy, but it's also a capacity of the heart of tuning into other people's feelings. Depending on what the heart type is, among 2, 3, and 4, then there is an adaptation happening, like to match the other person's feelings, but not necessarily. It's just a heart's knowing. And it's very quick, and it happens all the time. You don't even need to know the person much, although it may help if you know the person. Have I described it accurately? Can you explain us this mysterious thing? Mysterious for a non-heart type.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mysterious for us too, because it happens without us thinking about it. It's very automatic. And again, part of what's interesting about teaching this to people is we've had to think about it more, something that's usually very just unconscious. But I would say, for me, the way I would language it, and one of the things I've noticed when we teach the three centers, is using different language kind of gives a more accurate sense of what's happening. The way I think I would experience is, it feels like reading people, almost mm-hmm. energetically reading people. Mm-hmm. Now, you're reading the emotional state, but for instance, sometimes I'll have a sense immediately of someone who likes me or doesn't, someone who's open to me or not, someone who I can read how they're feeling or not. It's almost like, is someone available to me or not? Is someone feeling good about me or not? And this is a little bit more of the two angle on it too, I think. Mm-hmm. But generally, it's a sense of being able to read people or read a room and sense how people are feeling. I know, for instance, when I'm giving a talk in front of people, I'll be tuning into the people I feel like who are with me. Mm-hmm. You know, almost people who are connecting with what I'm saying, who are liking with what I'm saying. Sometimes I'll look at people and I'll think, ooh, either they don't like what I'm saying or they're not really listening to what I'm saying. And of course, that bothers me. And I go back to looking at the people who are approving of me, of course, to make myself feel better. But there is this
Which is to be emotional.
Exactly. There is this kind of sense of sort of the heart reaching out and connecting or reading with people.
So I find that brilliant. And I wish I had a little more of that. Now, it seems to me that the key thing is to understand that the one doing this reading is the heart, not the gut, like for body types when they try to sense everything around them. Like, the heart is the one reading the situation and getting the information first and then spreading it around to the rest of the organs or the, you know, all the being. Does this match your experience? Like, the heart is the one managing this whole thing?
Yeah, and it doesn't even feel like it's involving any other parts. it's not spreading the information. It's just it's the organ that is handling the whole thing.
And that is very, very, very different from body types and from head mm-hmm. types. Now, I have one more question for you before we talk briefly about how people of all types can develop the heart capacity. Now, my question is, you have described in your books, in your work, something that I really appreciate. You say that the core emotion for heart types is sadness.
Yes.
And this is new. You know, up to your book, authors used to say different things, shame or whatever, image, or just not, you know.
Or just feelings.
Feelings, yeah. So tell us about it.
So I really strongly believe that the core emotion of the heart types is sadness. Of course, the core emotion for the body types is anger. The core emotions for the head types is fear. And it's sadness for the heart types. I think it comes from the work of Oscar Achazo, who is the person who is the source of all the Enneagram information in the modern era. That's what he said, that these are the three emotions. But also, I believe that sadness is generated in heart types from an early experience of not being seen and appreciated for who you really are. I think we heart types get a message, and again, kind of subconsciously received from the people around us, that we're not really loved for who we essentially are, for our true self, but for what we do for people or how we present ourselves. You know, for twos, they kind of get the message. It's for when you're supportive of other people or when you're doing things to please others or give to others, that's when you get rewarded. For threes, I think it's about when they achieve things, when they perform well, when they're productive or effective or accomplished, they get the love. And for fours, I think they have a sense of it's when they're seen for who they uniquely are. And that's why they're often driven to self-express, or they want to be understood, because they want to stand out a little bit. They want to be seen as being unique or special. And I think in all these three ways, it's like we have to do something to get the love. We can't just be loved as we are. And I think that is the source of a bottom line sadness that the heart types have. And I've checked this out with a lot of other heart types. And I think especially people who've worked with the Enneagram for a long time and have done inner work, most heart types I know agree that it's sadness and that is the core emotion of the heart types, that's sort of the bottom line thing. Now, this doesn't mean that heart types go around feeling sad all the time, just like it doesn't mean...
Or that all the types don't feel sad.
Exactly. Or that body types are always angry, or that head types are always fearful.
It's just more central.
Exactly. It shapes the character, the relationship to that core emotion. And so, of course, in each of these three centers, there's one type that overdoes the core emotion, one type that underdoes it, and one type that's kind of in the middle or in conflict with it. I think in the heart center, the fours overdo sadness, the threes underdo it, and the twos are sort of a little bit in the middle in conflict. Sometimes they repress it, sometimes they're very in touch with it.
And in terms of developing the emotional center, it seems to me that it's crucial for everybody of all types to be in touch with all emotions like anger, sadness, fear, maybe also happiness, and also, you know, put oneself in the position of feeling more. Whatever makes you feel more could be a movie, could be a relationship.
Yes, exactly. Turning up the volume on feelings, making a practice of that. If you feel a little bit of something, try to get more into that. Try to understand what's going on there and leave more space for being more in touch with more emotions.
Oh. Now, what about the head types, the head center? What is your experience with me, for instance, as a business partner and a friend, given that I am a head center? What is it that surprised you?
So types 5, 6, and 7 are head-centered types. And I think it surprises me that it's just all about understanding and making mental sense of things. And that's so much of what the full picture is, and that oftentimes there's a way of not being connected to the emotions or the body. But I think it's all about analysis. It's about whether things make sense or not. It's about mental models. It's about compartmentalization. It's about different ways of thinking. But what do you think? You're the expert on the head center. Tell us what your experience is.
So the experience is that, for instance, during this 30 seconds that you provided this information and explanation of how you experience me and head types, I had 4 or 5 different ideas about it.
Mm.
So I remember the first time I told you that this is my process, that I'm hearing, but I'm thinking while I hear.
You're thinking a lot of different thoughts while you're...
Yeah. Your first reaction was, he never pays attention to me.
Yeah, no wonder he never listens to anything I ever say. He's having about 100 thoughts while I'm saying something. How could he possibly
Not true. I'm always paying attention to you. Is that I'm also trying to think of other new things and make sense of things. So if I am very much in my personality, my lower self, the head literally doesn't stop. And it's much more active than people who are not mental types. So, and I hate when people say that this is the intellectual triad. I don't think we are necessarily more intellectual than other people. I think this has to do with the level of education that people got and not the type.
Right.
So it's just using the head, but not necessarily in helpful ways. You know, it's just a vice, an addiction to using the head a lot. Now, if I'm too much in my personality, I'm using it to think of anything. Now, even if when I'm in a better place, when I'm very present, my head is still operating in another way. Like when you say something, I'm making sense of that in connection to everything else. So it's still using the head to understand a bigger picture, a bigger thing, making associations with everything. Like as a default, we come to the world like knowing how to do the SWOT analysis, like people in business do, like strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats and scenarios and different causes and consequences. We think in a complex way. This is a little bit of what it is to be a head type for me. And then fear as the main emotion. Many times it's very unconscious, and it's not any kind of fear. It's a fear of the unknown. So to me, it's like all head types, fives, sixes, and sevens, have some sort of intolerance against what they don't predict, what they cannot anticipate. They need to anticipate mentally what is going to happen, otherwise they will not feel okay. And fear is the intolerance to the unknown. Now, there are different kinds of fear. Like type 5's fear is more fear of feeling. Type 6 fear is fear of being, like being the authority. And type 7's fear is fear of suffering. So we use the head to make associations and understand things in the bigger picture. And like, as you said, like in therapy, in coaching, it's really more than half the way when we understand the problem. And many times just by understanding, we know the solution. And we even know what to do, really. Many times because we are head types, we need a push, right?
A push to action.
To action. But it's not that we don't know what to do. It's like when things make sense, we feel like we are ready. You know, so understanding something is perhaps 70, 80% of what we need.
I see.
And that seems to be different for, you know, you or other people who are not mental. Very surprisingly.
Yes, yes.
So how different is it for you?
Yes. Well, I mean, even the word understanding, I think, can mean different things. You know, there's mental understanding, but then there's emotional understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the big things for us HARP types is we want to be understood by others, and we often feel either misunderstood or afraid of being misunderstood. And that's sort of an emotional understanding. But I think what you're talking about is more of a mental understanding, yeah. Almost being able to create a mental model of what's happening, or like you said, organize your thoughts or figure something out. And even the language we're using, I think understanding can apply to different levels, but like figure things out, make sense of things.
Yes.
These different phrases can be important in just differentiating what the different centers are all about.
Yeah, and in a very basic level, the difference between the three centers is where we concentrate our vital energy. Like head types concentrate the energy around the head. Mm. Heart types around the heart, and body types around the belly. Right?
Yes.
So when we learn how to redistribute the energy all around the body, we are doing the work of rebalancing the centers.
Yes. And in our live workshops, sometimes we have people actually walk around putting their attention in different centers, and we have them do different things to evoke the experience of being a head type, a heart type, or a body type. And it's often very funny, for people to experience what it's like to be in a different center than they're in. Like I remember when I first would walk around trying to have the experience of a head type, I would get a headache or feel dizzy or like I was going to fall over. And people have different experiences when they kind of try to get into a different space than they actually live in every day.
And that's development. That it's not easy, but it's possible.
Exactly. And right. Trying or having a new experience can be really eye-opening in terms of having a sense of what the different experiences are depending on what type you are.
And then finally open up all three at once.
Yes.
Now, one of the ways to develop the mental energy is just by doing mental stuff. Could be reading news, and I see many types that avoid doing that are not mental, because either they don't like, but sometimes they come with an excuse that they don't feel well to read so many bad things.
Right, it makes them feel bad to know what's going on in the world.
Or they feel too much when they read, you know. Yeah. So that's something that you can do if you want to develop the habit. And by the way, you know, I think that self-help literature and, you know, some recent work on, you know, whatever self-development line we're talking about has somehow demonized the head. You know, it's like we need to develop the heart only. And it's not true. People who are not head types need to develop the head space.
Yes, and that makes sense. And I think our society, especially in the West, has been so head-centered for so long in ways that I think have been very unconscious and not very seen.
It's a pushback.
Yeah, it could be a pushback, a backlash to kind of finally realizing, wow, we haven't really been honoring the heart or the body at all, and our education system is completely determined by teaching to the head.
Right. But even things like, you know, doing crosswords, Sudoku or whatever, you know, or just talking. You know, promoting discussions with other people can be useful to develop the head.
Yes, and certainly as a heart type, it's been important for me to learn to be more objective, meaning taking the emotion out of it. And that's something that many head types can do quite easily, which is hard for me to do.
B and I decided to include the session called Top 5 at the end of each of our podcast recordings. We want it to be a fun and light moment in the recordings. It can be top 5 anything related to the Enneagram. Like today, we are going to talk about the top 5 friendliest Enneagram personality types. It can be friendliest also in the sense of happiest, but it's mostly coming across as being friendly or being perceived as friendly. Now, sometimes we are going to discuss not only types, but also subtypes in here. Like we can say sexual 9 or social 9 instead of 9 only, or not. It's our choice and it's very free. Now, if you don't know about subtype, don't worry, because you will learn about this as we record more podcasts, and this session might be useful for you also in this sense. So what is your number 5, B?
5.
So my number 5 person that, and when we say in personality, I think what we mean is before they've done a lot of inner work, let's say, just the basic personality, this is the sense of friendliness. So for my number 5, I put self-preservation 4. And this is a 4 that is a little bit different than 4s sometimes get stereotyped as, in that it can be a bit of a sunnier 4. It's a 4 that internalizes some of their emotions and usually puts on a happy face. So they can be pretty sunny and friendly and trying to do the right thing. So I put self-preservation 4 as my number 5. What about you?
So I was in a doubt between 5 and 4 here, you know, which one to put in number 5 or number 4, but I ended up having self-preservation 6 on 5. You know, this is one particular kind of 6 that comes across in a very warm and friendly way, just as a strategy to avoid problems with anyone outside there. Self-preservation 6s are usually smiling, or they tell jokes, or they're just nice people, and they come across as being friendly.
And it's a coping strategy for dealing with fear, right?
Yes.
Because they look for protectors and allies and friends so that they won't feel so alone and afraid, and so they tend to be warm people. In fact, the name for self-preservation 6 is warmth.
Yes, and you know, most of these cases of the most friendly ones, maybe, you know, what they need to develop, one of the things is to get more in touch with anger. You know, these types tend to be a little less in touch with anger.
Are we saying it's not good to be friendly?
Well, it depends. I mean, it may be good in life and in a functional way, but if these people want to self-develop more significantly, they may need to be less nice.
So maybe part of the personality's defense is being friendly for these types. And I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yes, and also not being in touch with the important emotion of anger.
Right, so friendly, of course, can be a very good thing, but being too friendly can also be a way of avoiding other emotions or other ways of presenting oneself that may be more authentic, let's say.
So my number four is social seven. I think that this is the specific four that is not only enthusiastic, like the sexual four. This is the type that comes across as being very nice to other people, very receptive, and they listen more to other people, and they help others when they are in deep need. They are sometimes very altruistic, and they put other people's needs and priorities many times first. They help, they do things that are unbelievable at times to help others.
So my number four, it's funny, when I first started, I had the same number five as you. I had self-preservation six as my number five, and then I switched it with self-pres four. So I actually have self-preservation six in the fourth place, and for many of the reasons that we just described, that you had it in your fifth place.
Right. What is your number three?
Three.
My number three is seven, and I didn't specify a subtype. I was thinking, is it one or the other that's friendlier? But when I think of all the sevens I know, I think all of them are pretty friendly. So I put seven in general as my number three friendliest outlook. They're, you know, pretty friendly generally.
You know who I put on number three?
Who?
I put you, Bea Chestnut.
Only three? Me? I always get stuck at three.
Oh my God.
Remember two top fives ago, I was at three, two, and I put you at one.
Oh my. Okay. I doubt that you have put social five like me on one this time. But okay. So self-press two is my third one. Mm. I think that self-press tours, you know, really want to be nice and come across as being friendly and cute. And they have this ability to make other people like them. Maybe they are the ones that show up as being the happiest of all twos, but also sometimes the most, you know, sensitive and emotional. But they are usually very nice people to be around.
Well, I'm looking forward to thinking what two other types you think are friendlier than us self-preservations twos.
And you've just heard an example of how pride is the favorite emotion here. We're all twos, not only self-pres.
I won't deny it. I won't deny it. Still always caught up in pride. That's true.
So what's your second?
Two.
So my second is not five. It's nine.
Nine in general?
Nine in general, yeah. Again, I tried to think of the three. I think maybe social nines are probably a little bit more friendly, but I think all nines are pretty friendly. And so I put nine as number two.
So my number two is social nine. I think that actually this is the second most friendly on the Enneagram. And I think they are really open to everybody else that, you know, comes close to them. It's like all my social nine friends are so receptive, are so nice. Sometimes they can also be a little fierce, forceful, you know, but maybe it's only a matter of making things happen, but it's hard for them to go against. Only social nines who develop more do that and become a little less nice. It's paradoxical because this is an example where becoming less nice is a sign of development. But in personality, they tend to you know everybody. You know, it's that kind of people that when you're leaving a social gathering, they take much longer to leave because they know everybody and they start talking to everybody and they, and they get hooked in conversations with pretty much everyone. You know, but that's also a sign of being friendly. Now, my number one is the sexual nine. I think sexual nines tend to be a little more friendly at times than social nines, even more so. Wow. I may be wrong, but this is my first impression given several sexual nines I know. I think they, as you explained, they tend to be not very aggressive, very friendly. Perhaps, you know, the social nine has a little less time for things, for people, because they are really workaholics.
Can be a little more business-like at times.
Business-like, yeah. And I think that sexual nines are really all the time paying attention to you and not to themselves. And they tend to be in agreement with you and come across as being calm and receptive. So this is my number one. What is your number one?
My number one is two.
In general.
And it's not because of pride. I was just thinking about, like, who do I interact with in the world that seems extremely friendly? And it's often when I meet other twos. And I actually put self-preservation and social because I think social twos fall into two categories.
Yes.
I think some social twos are among the friendliest people ever. Mm-hmm. They're just very effusive and outgoing and very attuned to other people. Mm-hmm. Other social twos I think can be a little more tough, a little stronger, a little bit more ruthless, or maybe at some times. So not all social twos, but some social twos and some self-preservation twos. I know self-preservation twos tend to be very charming and outgoing, and I'm not just talking about myself, but wanting to make a good impression and very pleasing. And so I kind of put both. I find one-to-one or sexual twos to be a little bit more remote, I would say sometimes. They tend to be a little more focused on one or two people and not everybody. Not everybody gets the super friendly treatment, although certainly some sexual twos are extremely friendly.
So basically you are saying that you are the friendliest of all people you know.
Well, I have to say, this is not really fully a pride thing because I don't necessarily think friendly is being, because sometimes when I meet twos, to be really honest, and they're super friendly, I think, wow, that person is really out of touch with their anger. It's almost like they're, you know, it's a little bit like self-preservation one can be super friendly in reaction formation, or, you know, the defense mechanism of type one to not feeling how resentful they are. I think sometimes twos can be that way. It's like they're almost too friendly. And I always think, uh-oh, like there is something going on in that person they are not looking at. Because if they could get more in touch with their resentment and anger or even sadness, they probably wouldn't be quite so friendly. So I'm not necessarily saying this is always a healthy thing, but I find that twos,
I think you may be right.
I think they really come out to meet you, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like they're really...
And twos, different from nines, they go towards people. Like, they are more proactive.
Exactly. Right? They're really active in doing things for you. In fact, we're staying right now at the home of a lovely two.
Yes. We are in Egypt right now, by the way.
We are in Egypt right now, and she is doing a lot for us and incredibly generous. And
yes.
And it seems, you know, very healthy in her case, but just a very friendly presence from the moment we walked in.
Yeah, this is Hazel, a friend of ours here in Egypt.
Yes.
Okay, Bea, I love talking to you. And you who listen to this podcast, we definitely hope that you got a lot from it. And stay tuned on the Enneagram 2.0 podcast.